Name that tune. You can't hear the melody, but you can probably tell this is the freestyle gritty piano crunch of the one and only Thelonious Monk. 50 years ago this week, he helped introduce bebop to the world. Did anybody thank him? There it is. Nice work if you can get it. We got it on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Nice work if you can get it. I'm John Hockenberry. Our friend Jerome Vaughn from WDET in Detroit is in for Adora Udoji. Good morning, Jerome.
Good morning, John. Coming up in this hour, we'll discuss what to expect in the Obama budget. We'll also take a look at restrictions on the sale of lingerie in Saudi Arabia. Those stories and more coming up, but first, let's take a look at the headlines.
Nice work, Jerome. You could call President Obama's 2010 budget a nice piece of work as well. He'll try today to see if Congress gets it. They may have to try a bit. Right now, the budget has a $3 trillion price tag, $250 billion of those dollars to provide additional funds for troubled banks, and that's on top of the $700 billion Congress approved for the bank bailout last fall. Meanwhile, the president says financial institutions need more oversight, and he's calling for stronger regulation of banks.
Financial institutions that pose serious risks, systemic risks to our market should be subject to serious oversight by the government.
The president's calling for what he calls 21st century regulations.
Automaker General Motors is posting a fourth quarter loss of $9.6 billion. The company says it burned through more than $6 billion in cash as well. GM executives are in Washington today to talk to the Obama Auto Task Force about another loan. It's received about $13 billion so far. The House is scheduled to vote today on a bill that would provide relief for homeowners facing foreclosure. It would allow them to go to bankruptcy court to reduce their monthly payments. President Obama called for the measure last week, but the mortgage industry has been lobbying hard against it.
Special envoy to the Middle East, George Mitchell, has kicked off his second tour of the region in Turkey.
Punctuation.
As an important democratic nation with strong relations with Israel, it has a unique role to play and can have significant influence on our efforts to promote comprehensive peace in the Middle East.
Comprehensive peace will be on the agenda when Mitchell travels to Jerusalem today to speak with Israel's Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu. Attorney General Eric Holder says federal authorities have struck a major blow against the Mexican drug cartels. Hundreds of people arrested. The distribution of drugs has been disrupted in a series of raids that began with an investigation 2 years ago in the Bush administration. The Dow and S&P both closed down more than 1% yesterday. They are poised to bounce up about the same this morning when trading opens. The S&P begins trading at 765. Get out your red pens. We want you to correct punctuation errors.
My punctuation pet peeve is use of the word at, as in where are you at? It's unnecessary.
Tell us your grammar pet peeves by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE or emailing mytake@thetakeaway.org. Punctuation mistakes and other grammar problems. You can go to our website for a conversation with a man out to protect the apostrophe. That's right, the apostrophe. It's threatened.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, if you're a stickler for punctuation, you can go through the budget today, which is going to be released later on this morning. The White House will release the official Barack Obama administration 2010 budget. It's $3 trillion. It's an enormous document. There will be lots of punctuation in it. We're serious about punctuation, though. Tell us your punctuation usage mistakes that need to be corrected in America or around the English-speaking world at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Apostrophes, commas, ellipses, you know, give us your thoughts on all of them. But back to the budget. It in some sense, it's pointless to talk about the budget because most of it is mandatory spending. It's either debt obligations or entitlement programs that are already sort of locked in. The amount of money that you can actually talk about in an actual federal budget is really a tiny fraction of the levers that the president and Congress can pull. They don't have control over very much, but one of the things they do have control over and of one of most concern to consumers is the issue of health care. And in many ways, this budget document is a vision for the Obama administration's plan to change health care. And joining us to talk about that, this slice of the budget that probably has all the debates wound up in it and is much more than a symbol of the entire budget battle. Joining us to discuss it is Jay Newton Small, correspondent for Time Magazine. She's in Washington. Jay, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
If we were to take just health care in this budget, there are a lot of revelations concerning both the style of healthcare delivery that the Obama administration envisions, and also how it's going to be paid for. All of that really can be found in this budget. Let's start with the kind of healthcare that the administration seems to envision. What have you been able to learn?
Well, this is just a roadmap, and it's sort of like a guidance for those negotiators in Congress that are going to be working on this plan for the next months to come. And what they see is, look, we're going to give you a pool of money that's going to be about $634 billion, and this is how much you're going to have to spend over the next 10 years on basically what they would call universal health care. Now, that definition is varying on what people would consider universal health care. Is it a mandate that every single American has to have health insurance? Is it provided by the government? Is it provided by private health insurers? And what we see in Obama's budget is something almost like a hybrid of these plans, and it's very in line with what he campaigned on, and that is it's not something that is provided by the government. It's provided by private health insurers, and it is something that does probably not have an individual mandate, although that's a negotiation point that the Hill will have to figure out themselves, because a lot of people on the Hill do support individual mandates, such as the Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus, and obviously the Health Committee, or Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee Chairman, which is Ted Kennedy, who's the big sort of driving force in this.
Right, and Ted Kennedy's been talking about universal 100% mandatory health care for virtually all of his political career. But let's just back you up there just to be clear on each point as we step through this. Obama campaigned on the issue of making health care more widely available, but short of a mandate. This is consistent with that campaign pledge, right?
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't envision a mandate, but envisions making insurance, health insurance, affordable and available to every American, which means that anyone who wants it can get it.
All right. So that means for a consumer, this program is going to subsidize certain programs, make them more cost effective, open the ability to actually be in the insurance pool. What specifically are consumers going to possibly see as this program gets nailed down?
Well, and this is all sort of just, again, a roadmap. I mean, you're putting the cart before the horse. You're saying, here's the money before we even know what's in the program.
Right.
And so these negotiators that have already been meeting for 3 or 4 months on Capitol Hill, they've been meeting since Halloween, haven't quite gotten to this point yet. And this is still open for negotiation. Obama is sort of saying, this is what I'd like to see, but we'll get to where we're going to be in a few months' time. And so they don't really know what kind of products we're going to see towards the end, and that'll be what happens on the Hill. This is not, I mean, it's not going to be like 1994 where they're going to, the administration's going to negotiate this huge program and then sort of try and ram it down Congress's throat. They're actually going to let Congress negotiate it, and they're going to be in the room and they're going to be talking about it and getting everyone involved, but they're not going to actually legislate it. And this is, more of Obama's wish list. This is what, if in an ideal world, this is the program he'd like to see.
But it's interesting. I see the fingerprints of Rahm Emanuel here, possibly, who knows very well what happened back in 1994. Into the Clinton years. We're leading, it sounds like, with we've got the money, let's come up with the program, as opposed to what the Clinton administration did. Here's the program, and then the Republicans slowly derailed it by saying it's going to cost too much. Let's talk about the $637 billion now. Where is that money coming from, and is it realistic?
Sure. About half of it, about $318 billion, comes from the tax cuts that are, you know, President Bush's tax cuts that are going to be expiring next year on the wealthiest Americans, those Americans that make about $250,000 a year. And then the other half, I mean, this is a $634 billion program over 10-year time, right?
Right.
So the other half of that money is going to come from basically savings within the Medicare and Medicaid and the amount of money we already spend on health care insurance. And
okay, let's talk about Let's talk about the first one. You said the money is going to come from tax cuts. I mean, of course, it's going to come from tax increases. You say cuts that are going away, but those tax increases are going to be on whom and how much?
Oh, you're right. Sorry.
I mean, well, no, I'm making fun of you, but you're right. I mean, you're right, but it's just, you know, thinking about people just waking up.
We get wrapped
up
in our Washington speak.
But there you go.
Yeah. It's the Bush tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans that we've seen over the last 7-8 years, actually about 6.5 years, for those Americans that make more than $250,000 a year. Those are going to go away. They're going to expire next year. And so we're going to get those increased revenues back into the system. And over 10 years' time, that's about going to equal $318 billion.
Right. Now, the cost savings in Medicare and Medicaid, these are the things that get me a little bleary-eyed. How exactly are they going to accomplish it? Is it specific here, or is it just sort of a general call for, you know, reducing waste?
Well, it's two things. I mean, there are specifics that are already out there, which were already passed in the stimulus. So there's two plans that were in the stimulus package. One is a plan to modernize our health records, because right now, most when you go to the doctor, you see them sort of filling out that paperwork. It's all in filing cabinets. It's moldering across the country. And every time you want to change doctors, you have to go to your doctor, get the physical things, and then, you know, bring them to the next doctor. And it's a real expense. It's time-consuming. It's a pain. And once you modernize those, you put them into a giant database. It'll be much easier for all Americans to change doctors, to bring their medical records with them wherever they go.
That sounds
great.
It'll
be easier for doctors to reference.
That sounds great, but does it mean $100 billion ka-ching? I mean, is that going to be cash? I don't see where
exactly.
The cash
comes. It means $100 billion ka-ching. Basically, that's what they estimate is anywhere from $100 to $150 billion, as high as $150 billion over 10 years in savings. So there's a big chunk of it. A second big chunk, and this is where it gets really controversial, is this plan that they had. It was about $1.1 billion in the stimulus to identify areas where they could make cuts. And this has never been done before. It's kind of amazing in the U.S. government that we've never examined what is cost-effective in Medicare and Medicaid. So they're going to take $1.1 billion, and they're going to study what is cost effective, and then they're going to cut whatever is not cost effective.
And when you say now, not cost effective, you're talking about actual services, right? So a reduction in services.
Exactly. They're going to say this costs too much and it's not worth it. We're going to cut it. So that's where things are going to get really controversial.
So those crutches you can't get, those wheelchairs, maybe that operation, these medications. Right?
Exactly. I mean, like that you know, $40,000 mechanized wheelchair that everyone's got going on right now, probably not the most cost-effective thing, might be something that you see cut. But we don't know until they've finished the study.
All right. Now, add it all up. What about there's one other thing which is going to get lobbyists inflamed before we go, and that is subsidies to particular insurance companies. Let's talk about that.
Well, that's part of the Medicare Part C program, and that's a program that was developed basically by Republicans to help subsidize insurance companies to go out into rural areas and provide coverage in rural areas. Now, that hasn't really worked out very well, and in fact, it's been a large pot of money that's already been rated every year for the Docs Fix, or which is an annual fix for the fees that are paid to doctors under Medicare. So there's still some money left in it, so they're going to raid the rest of that and kind of almost close down Medicare Part C. And so they'll get a couple billion from that or several billion from that. So there's all these different little areas where they're pulling money in and look, right now we spend about 17% of our budget on healthcare, and there's a huge amount of money that just isn't effective. And so what they're saying is it's going to be really painful. We're going to have to make some really hard choices, but we're going to have to reallocate a lot of this money because we're just not spending it effectively.
Well, Jay Newton-Small, correspondent for Time Magazine, it appears that the large debates about policy and vision are yet to come, but strategically, this budget at least sets out a notion that we have the money to pay for it if we do these first initial things outlined in the budget, leading with the money as opposed to with the policy. That's the strategic takeaway on the healthcare debate, and it comes straight out of the budget. Jay, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's an interesting takeaway. I wonder if this time around, if they lead with the money, they have more chance to get programs passed.
See, to me, I go, that's money that people are going to spend however they want.
Yeah, well, the debate begins.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Quick update on our punctuation debate. Heidi has a problem with the exclamation point. I like it. She says it has spunk, but some folks think it can excuse bad behavior, as in, sorry not to have responded to your desperate email for 2 months. I've been so busy. 6 exclamation points. Heidi says, doesn't work. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your punctuation suggestions or the things that drive you crazy. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Jerome?
Saudi Arabia is one of the most conservative countries in the world. It's also one of the wealthiest and one with a delicate balance between religious tradition and the modern world. That balance can erupt in disputes over the simplest details of daily life. Take, for instance, who should sell lingerie. You may think it's silly, but it really isn't. Currently, only men sell women's underwear. Joining us is Reem Assad, lecturer in banking and finance at Dar al-Hikmah Women's College in the city of Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. She's leading an online campaign and boycott to change the way that women's underwear in the country is being sold so women can sell it too. Good morning, Reem.
Hi, good morning.
Tell us about the campaign and the boycott that you're leading.
Well, it all started last July 2008, when I personally thought that the way that lingerie is being sold in Saudi Arabia needs to come to a complete change. We all faced some difficulties trying to buy and visit lingerie stores, so I thought that was it. I put it up on Facebook. It gained huge popularity, and here I am today speaking about it everywhere.
Now, how does this issue that you've been involved in, how does it bridge those delicate balances between tradition and the modern world?
Well, traditions need to be flexible enough to fit into modern living and daily life according to modern living. So I personally do not believe that there are fixed traditions that cannot or may not be changed over time. So that's for one. Number two, it is starting to get very irritating, the status quo, i.e. selling lingerie in Saudi Arabia via salesmen. It was starting to get too much for this new generation, for the population of women who are interested in making purchase and buying decisions. So in simple words, it was just not right, and this had to change. So I decided to take the initiative.
Now, you know, on first look, people, you know, may think this is, you know, an insignificant issue or something that they'll look at and go, okay, but why is this so important that you had to take action on it?
Well, in the Western world, this could be relatively or very insignificant. However, due to the very hardcore traditionalist mentality of the majority of the population of Saudi Arabia, matters that may seem insignificant abroad, they weigh a little bit more or significantly more in Saudi Arabia. So I'm really facing a current of traditionalists who are not interested in changing anything pertaining to women, their lives, their social and economic behavior. And that's where the difficulty and the challenge lies. It's not in the essence of the issue as much as it is in the opposition, the level of opposition to change.
Now, this month, an expert on girls' education became Saudi Arabia's first women minister this month as part of a wide-ranging cabinet reshuffle by King Abdullah. Are you seeing a wider move towards women's equality in Saudi Arabia?
I'm hearing, it's been stated very clearly by the monarch, his direction towards better living and employment conditions for women. He has clearly called for better employment opportunities, different sectors, governmental, public, and private for women, and he has made it very clear. Now, when it comes to, or when it boils down to execution, that's where the hiccups begin.
Now, your campaign, how do you see your campaign, your role in this wider movement?
Awareness is number one, simply because the women here have sort of gotten accustomed to the status quo, and a lot of them don't want to bother to change the situation. Some do, and others are just waiting for someone to jumpstart the issue or the initiative and then follow suit. So we do have a combination of people who are against or with or just, you know, neutral watchers or spectators. I'm trying to raise awareness that this is our right, and we as consumers definitely have the upper hand when it comes to the balance sheet of these stores in this sector. This industry is living off of the pockets of these women. And so long as they do not provide us with the right environment and ambiance to make our purchase decisions in an appropriate setting, then I don't see a reason why we should continue to buy from these stores, given the fact that alternative distribution channels do exist these days with the availability of broadband internet in Saudi Arabia, the availability of other stores that provide women-only sales teams. So this is coming as a more serious situation to the retail industry as opposing to what was in the past. In the past, there was a scarcity of stores choices. Today, the situation is different, and that's where I'm coming in.
Thank you very much, Reem. We appreciate hearing from you this morning. Reem Assad is a lecturer in banking and finance at Dar al-Hikmah Women's College in the city of Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. She spoke to us about her role in leading an online campaign and boycott to change the way women's underwear in the country is being sold. All women's lingerie in Saudi Arabia is being sold by men. Let's check in right now with Femi Okey.
Hi there, Jerome. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. President Obama predicts efforts to pull the nation out of recession with government spending will put the country even more in the red. He's estimating a deficit of $1.75 trillion. Today, he's sending Congress a 2010 budget for more than $3 trillion. General Motors is reporting another huge loss as its executives ask for up to $30 billion more from lawmakers. The Detroit carmaker says that it lost $9.6 billion in the fourth quarter. GM has received over $13 billion in federal loans so far. The Department of Homeland Security is launching a sweeping review of its operations. That's what the new head of the department, Janet Napolitano, told lawmakers yesterday. It's faced a string of allegations of mismanagement during Hurricane Katrina and bureaucratic waste. In international news, representatives from rival Palestinian factions are meeting in Cairo today for talks mediated by the Egyptian government. Hamas and Fatah are among them. Yesterday, the two groups agreed to release each other's members from detention, and all parties say they hope the dialogue will lead to a new national unity government for Palestinians. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
If you have a red pen, get it out right now because we need you to be America's copy editor.
Hello, my name is Vicky, and I'm a high school teacher. The apostrophe S's are just like sprinkled in like salt and pepper, and it's a possessive S. It's possessive, and people are using it to pluralize.
What's a grammar or a punctuation mistake you've seen or heard that needs to be corrected? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with yours, or email us with a photo of the offender to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And you can go to our website to learn more from the defender of the apostrophe. It's threatened, you know.
The apostrophe is threatened, but that's not all that's threatened.
Life's too short. You deserve a better bank. Move to the Royal Bank of Scotland and make it happen.
In a development that no doubt tarnishes the global reputation of Scotsmen as being frugal and thrifty, the Royal Bank of Scotland has announced the largest annual loss in UK corporate history. RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, is already 70% owned by the UK. It nearly collapsed during the credit crisis and announced, in addition to this loss, further steps to make it essentially a part of the British government. Joining us now, Andrew Walker, BBC economics correspondent. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
And if you were looking for a toxic bank or a zombie bank, the kinds of things that we've been talking about over here on this side of the pond, RBS might be a good first place to see what it looks like in actual practice. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, it's been frankly a disaster. As a result of the new announcements that we had a few hours ago, it looks like the government's shareholding in RBS is going to rise a little higher. It could well, by the time the process is over, end up being a figure more like three quarters. In addition to what the government has announced this morning is that it's going to be providing essentially insurance for RBS on something like $450 billion worth of problem assets. And part of the price that RBS is paying for that is by basically handing over more preferred shares, as they're called, to the British government. So it was already heavily owned by the government, and that stake is just going up a little bit further.
Now, pre-tax losses of $34 billion for 2008, I mean, that's the record. It's still a little bit less than some analysts thought. The ultimate goal is to get RBS to be able to lend, but with the amount of cash that's being infused into RBS, what is the ratio of the bailout money that's gone into RBS versus the anticipated loans that might come out the other side? Can you even compare those numbers?
Well, there's one number I can give you, which is what RBS's chief executive says is going to be the additional lending that the bank will be providing that it would not otherwise have done as a result of all this support. And he put the figure at 25 billion pounds. That's something of the order of $35 billion. So it's a pretty small figure in relation to the amount of support the bank has received from the British taxpayer. But then you have to bear in mind one of the things that support has already achieved is to have kept upright a bank that was quite likely to have fallen over altogether. And I think another point I'd make about that £25 billion figure that the RBS chief executive mentioned was he did say it was lending that the bank would not otherwise have done. Now, how on earth you are to judge whether it would otherwise have made a particular loan or not, I think it's rather hard to see, I think.
Well, I mean, there is a level of abstraction and almost absurdity here that it must be hard for British citizens to take. I mean, again, you just described about $35 billion in lending that the chief executive of RBS suggests it wouldn't otherwise have made. How much has the British taxpayer put up to generate even that trickle of lending?
Oh, wow. We've got a figure of, I forget the figure now, but we're looking at in capital injections of the order of 20 to 30 billion pounds, and then absolutely enormous figures that have been provided by way of guarantees on these toxic assets. It's not the government's not taking the full loss on that $450 billion or so worth of toxic assets, and undoubtedly the full losses won't come to as large a larger figure as that. But, you know, nonetheless, it is a very, very substantial amount of money, of taxpayers' money, that's potentially at stake there.
Right. There's one feature to this plan that I wonder if you could elaborate on before we go that might be something that would directly mirror what the Treasury is trying to set up with banks in the United States, and that is losses are insured to a certain point, but then after that, something is triggered. Can you explain exactly what happens here?
Well, what happens is that the losses in the first instance, in the case of of this deal with RBS up to about $27-28 billion. The first batch of losses are taken by the bank itself,
right?
And then losses beyond that are shared between the government and the bank, with the government picking up the larger part of any losses. And the idea of that is basically to give the bank itself and any other financial institution doing business with it reasonable confidence that they can know at least what the likely maximum risk is, and make them more confident about doing business with RBS, or in the case of RBS itself, advancing new loans, confident that it has the capital to withstand any losses that it is going to have to pick up itself.
Well, it's an enormous moving of the goals, right, on the field. You don't have to break even. You can just lose only this amount, and beyond that, the government will pick you up, right?
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it, yeah. Another way, of course, the way that Treasury Secretary Geithner is pursuing is the idea of simply taking the assets off the banks altogether. Either way, it's a way of transferring very substantial losses from private sector to the taxpayer.
And of course, it's certainly going to be a model for policy of the Obama administration as it goes forward to examine the very same questions with banks like Citibank and Wells Fargo and Bank of America here in the United States. Andrew Walker, thanks for joining us. BBC economics correspondent joined us from London, and now Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Sticking with the economy, we have news this morning of durable goods orders plunging. Bigger than expected, the drop is at the moment, 5.2% in January. And those figures actually reflect the new orders manufacturers in the US get to deliver factory goods. Unemployment claims also jumped up to 667,000. Those numbers are compiled weekly to show the number of people who file for unemployment benefits for the first time. The House is scheduled to vote today on a bill that would provide relief for homeowners facing foreclosures. It would allow them to go to bankruptcy court to reduce their monthly payments. Also in the House, lawmakers won't take their annual cost of living pay raise for the next year. It was set to go up automatically. Rank and file members of Congress make $174,000 a year, and it's not the first time members of Congress declined a pay increase. The last time was back in 1999. Boeing says that it's sending a team to the Netherlands to help investigate a Turkish Airlines crash near Amsterdam's main airport. Almost everybody on board survived the crash, but 9 people were killed, including both pilots. The Boeing 737 was en route from Istanbul. Let's look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Jerome Vaughn. With a brand new knee, Tiger Woods returned to action yesterday at the Accenture Match Play Championships in Marana, Arizona, just north of Tucson. In his 8-month absence, recuperating from reconstructive knee surgery, the golf world missed him dearly. Karen Krause is a sports writer for the New York Times, and she's in Arizona right now, where she's covered Tiger's first day back. She's on the line now. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So how did Tiger look yesterday?
He looked as if he had never been away from the game. It was as if he picked up right where he had left off at the U.S. Open last year on that 19-hole playoff with Rocco Mediate. Looked very sharp. Opened with a birdie and eagle. So I don't know if it could have gotten much better than that for him.
Wow. So obviously, I mean, he looks in this early determination back to his old form.
Right, and his swing coach, Hank Haney, has scoffed at the notion that he would be anything but that, saying, look it, Tiger played for 2 years on a knee that every time he took a swing at the golf ball, it would move around. His knee had no cartilage in it, so every time he was shifting the weight onto that left leg, his knee was so unstable that it was hard for him to anchor it. So now he has stable knee, of course his swing should be as good, if not better, than before, which I would imagine for the rest of the golfing world is a scary thought.
I was going to say, how badly did the golf world miss him during this convalescence?
Really, they missed him. Yeah.
Well,
right.
I would imagine if the golfers, if you gave them truth serum, they would say it was the greatest opportunity ever to try to pad their financial coffers and their money title titles, their resumes. But the truth is, everybody knows that Tiger is the tide that lifts all the boats. And you could tell yesterday there were so many more people out there than you've seen at any tournament since Tiger or in Tiger's absence. So I think you can tell through by just the attention that he's garnered in the media, the number of people who are following him. It was interesting. I was telling one of my editors last night that when you were out on the course, you seldom heard a roar from anywhere else. And it wasn't because the other golfers weren't making good shots. It was because most of the people were following Tiger's group. So there weren't enough people following the other golfers to induce roars. So that gives you an indication of just the power of Tiger and the draw that he is. He has this magnetic pull just drawing people to where he is.
He's a stimulus package, basically. Let's face it.
He is golf stimulus package. There's no question about that.
Wow. Well, thank you very much, Karen, for joining us on The Takeaway today.
All right. My pleasure.
Karen Krause is a sports writer for the New York Times, and she's in Arizona right now watching the magic of Tiger.
It's like I was thinking of hockey. You know, it's like a power play. Tiger's like off the links, okay, for like a year, whatever it was, months, and these guys had this chance. All these other golfers had this chance, and nothing.
Amazing. The lost opportunity,
but they're all happy. All those little golf boats are happy because they're lifting now.
That's right. Plenty of time on TV too, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And now time for the news headlines with Femi Oke.
And that time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. Automaker GM has posted a fourth quarter loss of $9.6 billion. GM company executives are in Washington today to talk to the Obama Auto Task Force about the company's request for billions more. Chrysler executives met with them yesterday. President Obama is sending his budget outline for 2010 to Congress today. It includes a provision providing up to $250 billion to prop up troubled banks. That's on top of the $700 billion Congress approved for a bank bailout last fall. The House is scheduled to vote today on a bill that would provide relief for homeowners facing foreclosure. It would allow them to go to bankruptcy court to reduce their monthly payments. Swiss bank UBS has a new top executive. Oswald Grubel is leaving rival bank Credit Suisse to take over immediately. UBS is facing a lawsuit from the Justice Department. The bank refused to disclose the names of 52,000 Americans who had accounts with them to keep their money from being taxed. And the special U.S. envoy to the Middle East, George Mitchell, is traveling to Jerusalem today to speak with Israel's Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu. He wants to jumpstart peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians. Netanyahu has said that he supports Palestinian prosperity, but not Palestinian statehood. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. For some styles of music, there's this moment of introduction, an instant when the sound of what's gonna be hits the ears of what we all know, and everything changes. Think of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring premiering in Paris and the riots it caused. The Beatles playing the Ed Sullivan Show and the riots they caused. Well, 50 years ago this week, one of the most influential jazz musicians in history gave a landmark concert at New York City's Town Hall. Thelonious Monk. His music had mostly been played solo or by a trio or quintet. At the Town Hall concert, he played with a 10-piece band. Monk's Town Hall concert was the moment when bebop jazz left shadowy nightclubs and moved to center stage. And here to take us back to that moment is WNYC music host Terrence McKnight. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks,
Terrence.
John. Good to be with you.
Put me there. I'm already there. What do you mean?
Well, right now we're in a place called the Five Spot, and we're listening to a composition called In Walked Bud. And Thelonious Monk wrote this and dedicated it to his good friend and colleague, Bud Powell. And this is where a lot of the bebop really fomented, you know, places like Minton's and the Five Spot, where people were like Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk, and these guys would get together and create this new music in the 40s and 50s. And finally, in 1959, as you said, that's when bebop hit the mainstream.
And these were incredible virtuosos, but they shunned the kind of flashy stage setup that, say, a Duke Ellington would have loved.
Well, these guys wanted really to be taken seriously as musicians and not so much as entertainers. And they looked at some of the music of the past, like from the swing era, and saw how these guys were serious musicians, but they were taken lightly, and people would talk over the music, and it was just sheer entertainment. So they wanted to create a music where people had to listen quietly, and people did listen quietly, and these guys played what they wanted to play. They didn't play to necessarily entertain or to appease an audience's sensibilities. They played what they wanted to play, how they wanted to play it. Now, if you listen to this tune that we just heard in Walk Bud, we're going to hear the tune from Mint when they played it at Town Hall.
This is from the concert.
This is from Town Hall, 1959. I believe it was February 28th. And this tune is Blue Skies Smiling at Me, Talking About Blue Skies. So a lot of time in bebop music, they would take old standards and use the harmony, not so much the melody, but they would use the harmony and reconfigure that harmony, because bebop was all about harmony and all about rhythm and some, you know, different shifts from the swing era.
So you hear the familiar, the old standard, but then you hear the dissonances, the experimentation, the improvisation.
And with this, you know, Thelonious Monk, who the prior year had been arrested and beaten by the police, he had gotten his cabaret card taken for the second time. That was 1958. And so for this same guy to come out of Minton's and the Five Spot and go to Town Hall, which at the time was New York's, which was perhaps the second concert hall in the city, Carnegie Hall, and then Town Hall, it was a huge deal.
So Monk's on piano, of course. Who's playing sax there?
Well, you've got Sam Jones playing bass, Arthur Taylor played drums, Donald Byrd played trumpet that evening, Eddie Burt played trombone, there was a French horn player named Robert Northern, Jay McAllister on tuba, Phil Woods on alto sax, Charlie Rouse on tenor sax, and Barry Sax was played by Pepper Adams. Now, all of this music, you know, was arranged by a guy named Hall Overton. He and Monk collaborated on this for this concert. Hall was a professor at Juilliard. And the two of these guys got together and worked tirelessly for weeks to put these arrangements in the form for a big band, because Monk's music was traditionally played by a quartet, quintet, and sometimes a trio.
So they understood what was at stake in this concert. They understood that this was really a rollout of a style of music that the huge audiences had not heard at all, and they wanted to get it right.
Yeah, I mean, prior to this concert, I mean, I think it was 1955, Monk showed up at the Newport Jazz Festival, and people really looked at him as if he was some sideshow or some type of freak. You know, he was very eccentric, and sometimes his style was, there were some things extra musical about his, or how shall I say, Monk would do stuff like, he'd be playing piano, then all of a sudden he'd get up and dance. You know, he'd like dance in a clockwise fashion and just kind of twist around and turn around and just jump back down at the piano and play these really angular rhythms. And it was just so brand new to many listeners who were accustomed to people like Ellington playing or Bud Powell or some of the better known pianists of that day. So this week at Town Hall, there's going to be a recreation of this concert. Thursday night, Charles Tolliver, a trumpeter who was actually at that 1959 concert, has recreated all of this music. He's gone in, listened to the records, and reorchestrated all of this stuff. He's going to present it Thursday night.
That's tonight. Yeah.
That is tonight. And then tomorrow night, Jason Moran, another pianist, is going to use some of the actual footage that was found in this rehearsal studio where you hear Monk talking, you hear Monk and Hall Overton talking about these orchestrations and putting all this music together. So you'll actually hear Monk's voice and see some of the photos that were taken during that whole period that they were rehearsing for this concert. So Town Hall tonight and tomorrow night, Monk's recreation of this 1959 show.
Wow. So before we go, the audience went wild 50 years ago.
I think we can hear some audience applause if we get to an end of a piece. But the audience was very receptive to this music. I don't think they knew exactly what to expect, but they were receptive. It'll be interesting to hear how receptive they are tonight and tomorrow night.
That's great. Terrence McKnight will be broadcasting from New York's Town Hall tonight at 8. Details are at thetakeaway.org. You can hear that broadcast on our website. Thanks, Terrence.
You bet.
Oh, yeah. The Takeaway's Terrence McKnight, evening music host at WNYC New York Public Radio. Thanks, Terrence.
I'm Jerome Vaughn, in for Adora Udoji. We're out to change the English language, the misuse of it, that is. Tell us your grammar gripes and punctuation pet peeves.
My name is Elizabeth Griffin. I'm calling from Detroit, Michigan. And my biggest grammar peeve is the word irregardless. I can't stand it. It's not a word. Professionals use it and abuse it.
Kristen in Massachusetts emails, a few weeks ago, John Hockenberry used the phrase, this begs the question, to mean this makes us eager to ask the question. But of course, when one begs the question, one avoids it. John, I'm begging you, please don't encourage this misuse.
Message received. You can go and catch up on anything you missed on the program by getting our podcast to go. Subscribe at thetakeaway.org. I'm learning my lesson. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Jerome Vaughn.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You know, it's become something of a ritual in the publishing world.
It's a build-up. It's excitement. Everybody wants to run, get their copy, hurry up, turn to pages of whatever their interest may be, and just kind of find out what's in there.
Seems like every year there's another title, and all the excited faces on Capitol Hill get to tear into another federal budget. Blueprint for a Vision of America, or the latest installment in a classic fable of the battle between good and evil?
This is where Voldemort actually comes back and starts fighting. It's so exciting!
Come with us as we take you into the land of hog wonks on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. I'm from Jerome Vaughn from WDET in Detroit is in for Adore Udoji once again. Good morning, Jerome.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, we'll discuss the Obama strategy in Iraq. We'll also look ahead to the president's meeting with the Congressional Black Caucus and examine the role of the apostrophe in English grammar. Those stories coming up, but first, let's take a look at the headlines.
President Obama is sending his 2010 budget outline to Congress today. It may be a quick read, but like the Harry Potter books, it should be pretty thick. The budget comes in at $3 trillion. At least $250 billion of them are going toward a provision to prop up troubled banks on top of $700 billion already deployed for the purpose. At the same time, the president is calling for stronger regulations of the financial sector.
Our regulatory system and each of our major markets must be strong enough to withstand both system-wide stress and the failure of one or more large institutions.
More regulations will protect consumers, the president says.
Some new economic indicators just out this hour may put even more stress on investors. The number of people who applied for unemployment benefits last week rose far more than expected. There were 667,000 new claims. Meanwhile, durable goods orders fell more than 5% in January, down for the sixth straight month. General Motors is posting a fourth quarter loss of $9.6 billion. The Detroit automaker says it burned through more than $6 billion in cash as well. GM executives are in Washington today to talk to the Obama task force about another loan. Chrysler execs met with them yesterday.
The House is scheduled to vote on a bill today that would provide relief for homeowners facing foreclosure. The mortgage industry is. Did you just say that? The mortgage industry was just, I'm lost here. Anyway, George Mitchell is on his way to the Middle East. In other headlines, the Dow and S&P both closed down more than 1% yesterday. The Dow begins trading at 72.71. It's poised to jump upwards, even though there's been bad economic news this morning. We're going to be talking with the defender of the misaligned apostrophe later on in the program. What's a big grammar or punctuation mistake that you've seen or heard that needs to be corrected?
Hi, this is Kathy Conlon from Detroit, Michigan. My pet peeve is people saying, I could care less. It's couldn't, people. If you could care less, why don't you?
Well, we're going to be talking with someone who's worried about punctuation in the English-speaking world. The defender of the apostrophe joins us later. But much more generally, we have a debate on grammar gripes and punctuation pet peeves going at 8778-MY-TAKE or on our website, mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here with Jerome Vaughn from WDET in Detroit, where we went on the air this week. It's been great having you here this week. And hello to all the Detroiters, right?
That's right. Good to be here.
Yeah, Detroiters and Michiganders, too.
That's an insult that's sometime. An insult. Might be Michiganians.
Michiganians, there we go. Well, the big story in Washington, of course, today is the budget. The release of the White House 2010 budget is scheduled any minute now. We're not going to talk about specifics in the budget, nor are we going to break down the spending. What we're doing at The Takeaway this morning is looking at important elements of the budget that really relate to consumers. And in this hour, we're going to talk about the Iraq War. If you open up the budget document, huge document, $3 trillion worth of document, the president's going to be asking for $200 billion for the war in Iraq. And this is the first time since the war began that the authorization for the Iraq War will actually be in the budget. The Bush administration, you may recall, had separate authorization for the Iraq War. But what does it mean? It seems that the Barack Obama plan for Iraq is to draw down combat troops, but to leave some residual force, perhaps as high as 50,000 troops, inside Iraq as a more or less semi-permanent occupation force of some kind. Well, what does it mean? And is it consistent with what Obama was saying during the campaign?
We should have a comprehensive strategy for bringing this war to a close and not what we've heard from the president today, which is essentially some tinkering around the edges and kicking the can down the road to the next president.
Well, the can is well in the domain of the current president, Barack Obama. And how consistent has he been? Listen to him on the Today Show in April of 2008.
I've been very consistent in saying that we are going to set a timetable and we will have a prudent pace of withdrawal, 1 to 2 brigades per month. At that pace, we can have combat troops out within approximately 16 months.
The key words there are combat troops out within approximately 16 months. Well, what does that mean? Joining us now is Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, nice to be with you this morning.
Now, you co-authored with Mr. Pollack a very long op-ed in today's New York Times called Iraq's Year of Living Dangerously, and there are a number of points I want to go through with you. First of all, is Barack Obama being consistent in what this budget calls for and what it looks like the next 16 months are going to be in Iraq with what he was saying during the campaign?
Well, you know, let me sort of take a different tack. I don't really consider consistency the cardinal virtue in this issue. You know, Iraq is a very dynamic situation, and I would commend any leader who's prepared to acknowledge that a situation today might be different from the one when Mr. Obama, for example, began his presidential campaign. If you like, that's an indirect way of saying, no, I don't think he's being totally consistent, but I don't care. I'd much rather see him focused on being successful than on being consistent. And I think that that's what he's tending to do. And he still will be able to honor the broad thrust of his campaign pledge, which, of course, was to end the Iraq War, because we certainly will be ending that war and drawing down forces regardless of which exact timetable he chooses. So I'm very reassured so far by what I'm hearing from him, especially compared with what I had expected. And again, that's a polite way of saying, no, I don't think he's saying quite the same thing he used to, but Iraq is not quite the same place it used to be.
All right, great. I don't want to get into a debate over individual timetables, but I do want to take a look at what appears to be a policy of maintaining a force inside Iraq, a non-combat force of as high as, say, 40 to 50,000 troops. What can 40 or 50,000 troops accomplish in terms of nation building in Iraq that 125,000 troops didn't manage to accomplish? And of course, we all remember the generals at the Pentagon being very upset about there being fewer troops than necessary in Iraq to maintain security.
Well, that's an excellent question. And you know, the situation is evolving. And, of course, the generals at the Pentagon don't want to stay in Iraq longer than they have to. After all, they're the ones that have to do the fighting and have to deploy their forces away from home. And the good news now is because of the great success of the surge, and by that I do not just mean the increase in troops under George Bush, but also the whole change in strategy, including the Iraqi contributions to that strategy. Because of that success, we're now in a position to gradually end this war, and the only question is how fast. The surge has already ended, as you know, and we've gone from 20 brigades down to 14, which is slightly below our historical average there, and we're going to be pulling probably 2 more brigades out this year. So we are definitely on the way out. It's just a question of whether you accelerate that process at the end of 2009 or sometime in 2010. And that matters a lot because of the timing and relation to Iraqi politics. They're having a big election in December, and I think it's much more prudent to let those elections happen, let a new coalition government perhaps be formed before we begin to rush out the door and potentially disrupt that very delicate process. As for your point about what's going to be left, you know, it's going to be a force that's focused on advising and on economic development, but that has some real combat capability in a somewhat reformatted or restructured way, essentially to protect American civilians and trainers, and also to be a bit of a hedge force just in case things get delicate inside Iraq, sort of a reassurance force. But it will not be out there on the streets of the cities actively fighting the counterinsurgency, partly because that counterinsurgency will be largely over, and partly because the Iraqis themselves, of course, will be capable of doing it as they increasingly are today.
Now, you've got great experience in the region, but I don't want to betray any sources here. But to the best of your knowledge, is Petraeus on board with this?
Well, you know, I think, as you know, there are these three different options, 16 months, 19 months, 23 months. In terms of how long it would take us to do the drawdown. And each one of those forces would envision a residual presence that, as you just said, I think from what I understand is a correct assessment of still 40,000 to 50,000 U.S. troops at the end of the process. And I think phrasing the options or structuring them in that way gives a lot of reassurance to various people in the command, because what they feel is we are not really drawing down to zero, and in fact, we're not really drawing down to zero combat capability. We're just focusing the mission much differently, keeping residual combat power essentially within a broader structure of an advisory kind of unit. And I think that does give considerable reassurance to the various commanders. I believe they would still prefer the longer time horizon, if I had to guess. No one has actually said that to me in so many words.
Right.
I do know these, a number of these people fairly well, but even so, even in discreet private conversations, I think they've been less focused on trying to lobby hard for one option and more focused on trying to help President Obama think them through himself and make sure that whichever option he chooses has a responsible amount of residual power at the end. And that's not, by the way, meant to be a permanent kind of residual presence, because by the end of 2011, this force would have to be all the way out, or there'd have to be a new agreement between Washington and Baghdad to authorize a new kind of presence, because, as you may recall, the Status of Forces Agreement that was negotiated late 2008 requires us to be all the way out by the end of 2011.
All right. Well, that's interesting. Now, you make in your op-ed, or let's step back a second, a very logical case for a kind of incremental scenario going forward to that 2011 or 2012 moment in Iraq. But you also describe, and I think very accurately, the situation between the Kurds and the government of Mr. al-Maliki and the sectarian battles in the south that are still brewing. Yet it seems to me that, you know, possibly we're just postponing a situation that is bound to erupt between the Kurds and the south, and that maybe the $200 billion should be spent on partitioning this country rather than betting on an incremental sort of evolution to some sort of democracy, which really isn't consistent with how things work in Iraq. It's not an incremental kind of a place, Michael.
Well, that's a great question, too. And what I would say to you is, you know, I largely agree. And there is sort of a partitioning of Iraq because Kurdistan is very much an autonomous place, one of the most autonomous places on earth relative to the central government with which it has some kind of a relationship. But the question, and the reason why your option is not so easy or simple, is because we got to figure out where to draw that partition line. And right now, the Kurds are not happy with its present location. And the constitutional process that we helped engineer back in 03, 04 actually allows for a process of rethinking where that line should be and whether it should be a simple line or whether there should be other entities created that essentially have a third kind of status, not Kurdistan and not Iraq proper, but some additional kind of neutral or autonomous status, especially around the city of Kirkuk, which the Kurds tend to view as their Jerusalem and which has a lot of oil in and around it, but the Arabs also consider to be important to them. So I'm with you. I mean, we're essentially witnessing the soft partition of the Kurdish regions of Iraq, but the debate now is where to draw the line. And by the way, I think the south is much better. And
right.
So I think that what you're seeing is a process where the problems are getting solved, but this big one and maybe one or two others are still there.
Well, fascinating discussion, and that's a great takeaway, the soft partitioning of Iraq. That's what we're witnessing here. Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution, thanks as always so much for joining us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So, Jerome, let me try this out on you. Jerome Vaughn, News Program Director at WDET in Detroit, The Takeaway's, ' best friend in the Motor City. Is that correct?
I think that would work pretty well. The period.
Period. I forgot the period.
Period at the end.
Oh. Needed. America's copy editors. You folks might be one to do the job. We're asking for your grammar and punctuation annoyances, the things that drive you crazy. We're going to hear more about that from the founder of the Apostrophe Protection Society in just a moment. But call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your most hated grammar or punctuation mistakes. Send us a picture of one at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And joining us now is John Richards, founder and chairman of the Apostrophe Protection Society. He joins us from Boston, Lincolnshire, in England. John, thanks so much for being in the program.
It's a pleasure.
Now, the Apostrophe Protection Society would imply that the apostrophe is under threat. Could you describe the threat, please?
Oh, it is indeed. It's either used where it shouldn't be or left out where it should be. People seem to regard it almost as random. They put it in where they think it might be, leave it out where they think it shouldn't be. And yet the rules are very, very simple.
Well, before we get to the rules, I'm actually a little bit surprised at how quickly our audience responded when I suggested that maybe there was a problem with the apostrophe. Listen to this.
Hi, this is Carol from Red Bank, New Jersey. I'm calling about the word it's, which is a little pesky. Normally with possessives, we always use apostrophe S. However, with it's a little tricky because sometimes it's can be it is, in which case you do use apostrophe, or if it's the possessive, there's no apostrophe.
So, John Richards, does she have it right, our listener there?
It apostrophe S is short for it is or it has. It, in the possessive, the dog liked its bone, no apostrophe.
Now, isn't that the basis of the problem, though? Because here you got this incredibly common word, it's, that doesn't have an apostrophe. All the other possessives have an apostrophe. I mean, you know, you're given conflicting signals here. The apostrophe is creating its own problems for itself.
Well, yes, it is an anomaly. It just has to be learnt. There are various parts of English grammar and foreign grammar which just have to be learnt. And it used in the possessive sense, does not take an apostrophe any more than yours or ours in another context do.
There
just
you go.
Learn it.
Right. Yours. Just learn it. Right. Exactly. Just like my mother told me. Let's talk about other threats to the use of the apostrophe. Certainly the Internet has produced all kinds of abuses of punctuation. What have you seen?
Well, the main reason is its use in plurals, its use in single letters or numbers. Someone writes in, I have three A's in my exam. And they write it A apostrophe S. That's very common indeed. There's no need for an apostrophe. Mind your P's and Q's. No need for an apostrophe.
So in that situation, it just looks better because the apostrophe makes it seem like it's more correct. But you just put a P and an S there.
Yes.
That's the way it works, right?
If you read that sentence without apostrophes, it's absolutely clear what it means. There's no confusion about it at all.
And is there ever a confusion between quotation marks and the apostrophe that is alarming to the apostrophe itself?
No, I think the two are fairly distinct. I haven't come across that problem.
If there is a punctuation mark that most frightens the apostrophe, what would it be? The semicolon?
The semicolon is very, very tricky. A lot of people don't use it at all. It's sometimes used incorrectly. The comma is also fading away, I notice. And the comma is as vital as the apostrophe. Sometimes it could change the meaning of a sentence.
This is Jerome Vaughn. Just a quick question. You know, as you've been dealing with this, you've been trying to set up the defenses to protect the apostrophe and the other bits of punctuation. Are you finding that the problem is that we're just lazy in how we're using language these days?
I think you've got it. Laziness and ignorance. Laziness is probably the worst. People just can't be bothered to find out the correct way. Birmingham City Council in England is determined to leave off the apostrophe on street signs like St. Mary's Road. I don't think it's due to anything apart from sheer laziness. It's just too much bother to do it correctly, so they just wipe out all the apostrophes.
So they blight the city of Birmingham with all this grammatically incorrect signage?
Exactly, yes. And there's been a great deal of protest about it, but I think they'll go ahead.
They'll go ahead because they're ignorant and lazy, right? There you go.
Well, you said it.
So what can we do to encourage people? And I think the one that really maybe relates to our audience the most is this use of apostrophes on single letters and things where you're creating a plural that maybe isn't an actual word, but you throw an apostrophe in there just to make yourself look good. How do we encourage people not to do that?
Well,
it is a problem, isn't it?
I wish I knew. Yeah. I get an enormous number of emails from the UK and from the US about this, and I always reply, it's not necessary. And if you write, I got three A's in my exam, there's no way you can misunderstand it.
Right. You know, John, I, as I'm talking to you here, you know, if anything should ever happen to you, is there someone to take over the mantle?
Well, I do one. My son, Stephen, is very interested, but he has a full-time job. Unlike me, I'm retired. So he may not be able to give as much time to it, but I hope he would take it over.
What's Stephen doing these days?
He's working in London in statistics.
Statistics, well...
I don't quite know what he does.
Well, John Richards, the founder and chairman of the Apostrophe Protection Society, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
John Richards is trying to save the apostrophe from Boston, Lincolnshire, and England, fighting the forces of ignorance and laziness throughout the world, as we always do here on The Takeaway. Femi, okay, do you have some headlines?
I certainly do. 28 minutes past the hour. The president's new budget for next year includes another $250 billion to prop up troubled banks. That would be on top of the $700 billion stimulus Congress has already approved for dealing with the nation's financial crisis. The new Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, says that fighting drug cartels is a top priority for her department. Yesterday, federal authorities announced that they're making progress fighting a major Mexican drug cartel. In the latest operation, they arrested over 750 suspects and seized almost $60 million in cash, drugs, and assets. In international news, representatives from rival Palestinian factions are meeting in Cairo today for talks mediated by the Egyptian government. Hamas and Fatah are among them. Yesterday, the two groups agreed to release each other's members from detention. And in Washington, D.C. today, the Chicago Bulls will be dropping into the White House to meet with President Obama. He's an avid basketball player himself, although I don't expect the players are going to be bringing their gear for a pickup game. As a look at stories making news this morning.
Is there a basketball court on the White House grounds?
Do you know? I will find out.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Our grammar debate continues. Good morning. I'm John Hockenberry with Jerome Vaughn in for Adora Udoji. He's from our newest station, WDET 101.9 in Detroit. Hello, Detroit. Diane writes into our website, thetakeaway.org, when did the T in often become not silent? Arg, it's often epidemic. Jeremy writes, is there a pill available that could be slipped into teenagers' food that would instantly and permanently eliminate the use of like in their vocabulary? That's a great approach, Jeremy. Like, we want to offend like that demographic on this program? I don't think so. Give us your suggestion at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us your grammar pet peeves at thetakeaway.org. Or Jerome?
My pet peeve, yep. Difference between fewer and less. Commercial out there now that says less movies drives me crazy whenever I see that.
That's a good one.
Well, today, President Obama meets with the 42 African-American lawmakers who comprise the Congressional Black Caucus, established 40 years ago. The caucus is questioning whether it has more legislative muscle now that the nation has its first African-American president. Congresswoman and Congressional Black Caucus Chair Barbara Lee has some ideas about that. Good morning, Congresswoman Lee.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Well, what are some of the main issues that you'd like to discuss with President Obama today?
Well, of course, the economy is on everyone's radar. Millions of people are suffering. The foreclosure crisis has wreaked havoc in the lives of millions of our constituents and millions of people who actually live in Republican districts. And so, you know, I was really proud of the fact that the president has attempted and will continue to work in a bipartisan way on all of these challenges that face our country. So we will be talking about many of these issues. We will be talking about a broad agenda that supports his efforts. Of course, we're the legislative branch, and we have to make sure that our legislation and our budget priorities, you know, are consistent with the White House. And as the conscience of the Congress, which the Congressional Black Caucus has been known for many years, it's our job to actually communicate, of course, the voice of the voiceless, and to make sure that those who have been shut out and have had no participation in our government, that we will continue to ensure that there's equality for all, and that what we call these moral gaps begin to get closed.
Now, you know, President Obama has a lot on the table, the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. He's dealing with wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Is the president going to have the time, the political capital, to get on to some of these other key issues in the days ahead?
When you listen to his address the other night, I think he laid out a very clear roadmap. He talked about energy, health, education. He talked about addressing the military budget, the Cold War era weapon systems, the no-bid contracts in Iraq. And so I believe that this president, given who he is and his commitment to change, he's smart, he's steady, he works hard, he's put brilliant people around him. I think he's going to accomplish everything he says he's going to accomplish.
Now, one of the things that the caucus has really been focused on over the years has been urban issues. Where do you see the president going forward on that? And again, is he going to be able to really do anything with these financial restrictions and all these other large problems?
Well, I believe he has established an Office of Urban Affairs, and when you look at the issues he talked about the other night, health care, energy, education, these are all urban issues. He comes as a former community organizer. He knows urban issues, and so when you look at the fact that millions of jobs have been lost in urban areas, when you look at the economic recovery package, the workforce training, the funding for jobs for young people, the Green Job Initiative, when you look at the infrastructure initiative, I believe that the economic recovery package reflects what urban communities desperately need, and that's jobs and a safety net and a government that's responsive to the needs during this, of people during this downturn, recognizing that this has to be a public-private partnership and that there's personal responsibility in all of this. I think he has laid out a very clear role for government and for urban areas.
Now, President Obama, first African-American president, has his election changed the role or the relevance of the Congressional Black Caucus?
In no way has his election changed the relevance and role of the Congressional Black Caucus. This is our 40th year. And the mission of the Congressional Black Caucus historically has been to be an advocate for the African-American community and other communities of color and other communities to ensure that there's justice in our government and there's some parity and equality. And until that unfinished business of America is completed, there will always be a role. And now it's even more important. We have four committee chairs, 15 subcommittee chairs. The Congressional Black Caucus members bring a perspective that I know the president understands and recognizes. And in working with members of the Congressional Black Caucus, I mean, the entire Congress understands that our issues are American issues and will make our country all the better for our role and our participation.
Really quickly, you're going to talk about Senator Burris at today's meeting?
We're still working on the agenda. The agenda for the meeting, mutual agenda around issues, around policies, around agenda, and around how we can support the president and what the priorities are of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Thank you very much. My guest was Congresswoman and Congressional Black Caucus Chair Barbara Lee. The Congressional Black Caucus will have their first meeting with the president later today. Let's check in right now with Femi Okeh and get the news headlines.
Thanks, Jerome. 21 minutes to the top of the hour is the time. The number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits for the first time rose last week. Figures were 36,000 people higher than the week before, and that's the highest level of new claims since 1982. General Motors is reporting another huge loss, almost $10 billion. GM executives are going before Congress to ask for up to $30 billion more today. The company has already received over $13 billion in federal loans. In international news, investigators in the Netherlands are taking a very close look at the wreckage and black box recordings of a Turkish aeroplane that crashed at one of Amsterdam's major airports. It was carrying 134 passengers and crew. Many escaped with only minor injuries. Student Kerem Ozil was a passenger. He was sitting towards the back of the plane. He actually walked away from the wreckage. He told CBS News what happened.
And we crashed by tail, and the tail took off or something. And I was sitting at the back of the plane. Plane crashed into two. I just climbed and walked away.
Nine people died after the plane crash had landed and just 2 miles away from the runway at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. Now, I mentioned earlier this hour that the Chicago Bulls will be dropping into the White House today to meet with President Obama. My dear co-host, John Hockenberry, said, so is there a basketball court there? Thank you to the news team and Stephanie Hughes, who brings us news you can use. George H.W. Bush installed the basketball court back in 1991. It's next door to the swimming pool.
Part of the Bush legacy. Thank
Absolutely.
You, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Jerome Vaughn.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And no giggling, okay, during this next segment, all right?
No promises.
Okay, excellent. All right. Now, it's 6 billion people in the world, okay? Most of them don't have access or even are able to use toilet paper. And most of the people in the world who do use toilet paper tolerate a texture of toilet paper that would make most Americans run screaming to the psych ward. All right? Americans demand this.
Now when you gotta go, you can go strong or you can go soft. Introducing a new world of Charmin. New Charmin Ultra Strong in the red and Charmin Ultra Soft in the blue. Rediscover Charmin. Choose the one that's best for you.
No, Americans demand a level of smoothness in their bathroom tissue that has enormous environmental consequences and is also a matter of taste that is of the very, very, very smallest minority of people in the world. Leslie Kaufman joins us. She's a reporter for The New York Times at the environmental desk there. The demand by Americans for a specific texture in toilet paper has extraordinary environmental consequences. Could you lay them out for us?
Well, according to environmentalists, it's not just according to environmentalists. It requires trees. That's it. In order to make really soft toilet paper, you cannot use anything that's recycled. You have to use trees. And so we cut down millions of them to make toilet paper.
And the marketing and the usage of this high softness toilet paper, which requires pristine wood, not recycled paper, is actually growing.
Well, the premium end has crashed suddenly, but over the years it's grown quite a lot, and people in America really like it soft. And it's sort of funny, other countries, as you mentioned during the intro, do not have that desire, though it does appear the more Western you get, the more you seem to think softness is necessary in your toilet tissue.
So here is an example of where, you know, the environmental rubber really hits the road here. I mean, how do you turn something that is such a matter of taste and so intuitive on the part of Americans who know nothing other than this kind of soft tissue into a legitimate environmental issue that will cause people to change their behavior?
Right. Well, that's what they're hoping. I think places like the Natural Resource Defense Council and Audubon and Greenpeace have been working very hard to make people aware, as they're not quite aware right now where their toilet paper comes from. Most of us just don't think about it. I put myself in that category.
But it's a marketing issue. I mean, you have to be willing to come up with slogans like, if you're willing to be chafed, you can save the world. I mean, really? It's as simple as that. You can't allow commercials to perpetuate this mythology.
I'm afraid.
I said no giggling. I said no giggling.
I know, you said no giggling. You know, I have used some recycled stuff lately, now that I'm more aware. I went out to the Markal plant, which is in New Jersey, where I live, and where they actually used my recycled paper to make the paper. And I have to say, I think I can stand it.
All right. Well, I mean, you know, it begins that way, one consumer at a time. Leslie Kaufman, reporter for The New York Times at their environmental desk, talking about the tastes of Westerners' toilet paper habits and the environmental consequences of that. Thanks, Leslie.
Thanks very much.
I'm never gonna wipe my butt.
He's never, never, never gonna wipe his butt.
I don't wipe my butt. Because it's a waste of toilet tissue.
Right.
My brown, crusty stains are an environmental issue.
Okay.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A radical vision for early childhood education. Is it there in the fine print of the stimulus package? We'll find out just one moment from now after headlines from Femi Okeh.
And the headlines coming to you just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama is sending his budget outline for 2010 to Congress this morning. It includes a provision providing up to $250 billion to prop up troubled banks. The House has passed a bill that will ease travel restrictions for Cuban Americans who want to travel to Cuba. They will be allowed to visit once a year instead of once every 3 years. The special envoy to the Middle East, George Mitchell, is meeting with Israel's Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu. He will try to jumpstart stalled peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians. Meanwhile, on a more practical note, Israel is preparing to allow 90 tons of pasta to enter the Gaza Strip. The Israeli government had stalled the donation for 7 weeks for security reasons. Israel said that it didn't consider the food to be necessary. The release comes after a major outcry from the international aid community. And a 32-year-old orangutan called Bonnie is making news in the orangutan world. Bonnie, who lives at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., has taught herself how to whistle. Orangutan experts are very excited because it was thought that orangutans have a fixed number of sounds which are automatically tied into their emotions. Bonnie, learning how to whistle, provides some tantalizing clues into how our ability to speak has evolved.
Orangutan news. Is there an orangutan channel?
Okay, hold on 1 second. I can't do this segment without actually showing you some Bonnie.
I don't believe that orangutan. Yeah. That's a whistling orangutan.
This is Bonnie whistling at the National Zoo in D.C.
Not bad.
It's pretty good. And you know, orangutans have very large lips. It's probably quite difficult to whistle. I don't whistle much.
This just in. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Lights, camera, action!
I'm Jerome Vaughn. You're not going to hear this anywhere else. This is our outtake segment where we hear a different take on an important issue throughout the week. This week, we're examining education in the stimulus bill. We've already looked at better ways to use the money going to schools and how to move schools further into the 21st century. Today, we're going to take a look at how the stimulus is or isn't funding early childhood education. President Obama made sure that education was a key part of the stimulus bill.
Already, we've made historic investments in education through the Economic Recovery Plan. We dramatically expanded early childhood education and will continue to improve its quality because we know that the most formative learning comes in those first years of life.
We're joined by Cornelia Grumman, Executive Director of the First 5 Years Fund. Cornelia, is this investment going to the first years of life or just continuing what we've already been doing?
Oh, no, this is something very different. So Obama's come in with a different philosophy that a child's brain doesn't just flip on like a switch at kindergarten, but it really is that learning starts at birth, and you need to really start doing mindful, you know, education and care in those earliest years in order to sort of form the brain and to form all the learning systems that have an effect for a lifetime.
There's Head Start, and then there's, you know, there are other programs addressing those first 5 years of life. Are we talking about a radical shift here?
Well, it is. I mean, it seems subtle, but it is pretty radical, and it's informed by a whole raft of research that's been coming out in the last 10, 20 years that looks at the science of what's happening in the brain and how the brain architecture forms in those earliest years of life. And also in economic research that shows that if you really have very good quality care in those first years of life, that you can reap all kinds of dividends in terms of, you know, lower dropout rates, higher adult earnings, less grade retention, less special ed. So there's really terrific research on this, and I think that's what Obama's policies are being informed by.
We're not talking about in those first 3 years spending money on, you know, teachers or schools or books or anything. What is that money going to be well used on for the first 3 years of life?
Right. No, I know some people think, well, what are you trying to put babies in desks? And no, that's not what we're talking about. You know, some of these are subtle, and for some parents, this is innate. Like, you know, when you go to the grocery store, some parents, it's a running dialogue, a running narrative as they're walking down the aisles and talking to their child, even though the child may not have verbal skills or really know words yet. But that is so critically important. But a lot of families don't know that this is so important for language acquisition. The quality of the interactions between the caregiver and the child is so important, and that's why it requires more than just babysitting. It requires real training of the teachers. We also live in a different economy now, so that the reality is that a majority of kids are in some kind of other care other than just the home. So. Because parents have to work in this economy or try to find work. So the reality is we have to really improve the quality of the kind of care outside the home that we put our kids in.
Now, how's all this sort of reflecting on President Obama's priorities?
Well, you already see it reflected in the recovery package, where there's, you know, roughly $5 billion investment in early childhood, because he realizes this is important not just in the short term for the economy, but for the nation's long-term economic health, that you really need to invest in these years. And it's really a pretty efficient investment. I mean, you can invest now or you can invest later in remedial education and, you know, repeat grades, in special ed, in juvenile corrections. So this is really, especially for the most at-risk kids, it has a huge impact on their lives. Also, we know that there is evidence that the achievement gap, we think of the achievement gap as showing up in elementary school and beyond, but in fact the first evidence of that shows up as early as 18 months old.
Wow.
So if we can get at it at 18 months old or even earlier, and there are programs that do this.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Programmatically, yeah. What is this going to mean? I mean, is that money going to be targeted to fundamentally new kinds of programs, or is it an extension of Head Start into the earlier years? What infrastructure is available to actually bring in these younger toddlers, really, and infants under the umbrella of early childhood education that Head Start has already been serving for years now?
Well, actually, within Head Start, there's a program called Early Head Start, which is relatively new. It's only about 10 years old, but that's geared for infants and toddlers. And it's a terrific program. It's actually very effective. Very few people know about it because it's relatively new. Head Start has been around for a while, but that really addresses preschoolers more. But Early Head Start is terrific, and I think Obama also, I mean, in his campaign platform, he wanted to quadruple the number of Early Head Start slots, because right now only about less than 3% of the eligible kids actually get Early Head Start services. So he's really trying to increase that. And you see that in the recovery package. There's a huge investment in Early Head Start, which is terrific.
So just really quickly, tell us, why is this stimulus? Why is this being characterized that way?
Why is investment in early childhood stimulus? Well, first of all, you know, in some states, the early childhood industry rivals that of the hotel or restaurant or even construction industry, and people sort of forget that.
That's interesting.
This is a really big. It's a sort of fundamental base of the, you know, or it's a fundamental part of the economic base in a state, and so this is essential. It's essential for parents to either find work or to keep their jobs and to keep working and to keep their families healthy. And if those parents don't have reliable, high-quality early childhood, it's not going to do their children any good, and it's not going to do them any good if they're having to come out from work and deal with a crisis, or, you know, if they're having to shuttle their kids around all day to different forms of informal, unreliable care. So this is really vitally important to the economy, both in the short term and the long term.
Thank you so much for joining us, Cornelia. Cornelia Grahmann is the executive director of the First 5 Years Fund.
Thank you, Jerome. We're always on. President Obama is announcing his budget, as we've been talking about all morning. You can get an analysis throughout the day on our website, thetakeaway.org. And on quite another matter, get out your red pens, because we want you to make some corrections to the misaligned English language, not in the budget, but in everything else that's written. Tell us your grammar gripes and punctuation pet peeves. And there's one specific error that you really want to target here.
It's IT apostrophe S versus ITS.
It's, which is a little pesky.
The most common error in punctuation.
The apostrophe S is just like sprinkled in like salt and pepper, and it's a possessive S.
Beyond the it's crisis, help us make some corrections and tell us your grammar gripes at our website now, thetakeaway.org. And, you know, that's where your takeaway comes from.
They put it in where they think it might be, leave it out where they think it shouldn't be. And yet the rules are very, very simple.
Of course they are. John Richards, chairman of the Apostrophe Protection Society. That's his actual title. He understands the rules. If you missed anything like that conversation with John Richards on English punctuation, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Jerome Vaughn from The Takeaway's newest station, WDET in Detroit.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Good morning, Detroit. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.